My question deals with some of the material from the two series, Views on Socialism and Communism, and the Basis, the Goals, and Methods of the Communist Revolution. I've been thinking about two things. One is a statement by Arundhati Roy in an interview where she basically said, this is a paraphrase, I support the Maoist in India, even though I would probably be the first person they would kill. Second, I've been thinking about this in relation to the need to make a distinction, as you've emphasized, between those who are actively plotting to overthrow the socialist state and those who are just dissenting or even vehemently opposed to it, but not actively plotting to overthrow it. My question is, taking into account the socialist experience and the very secondary aspects where Arundhati Roy might have a point based on what happened in China, and also taking into account the particularity of India and the particularities of this country, what should communists say to the Arundhati Roys of the world in relation to this contradiction, and why should they believe us?
Well, let me start out by saying that I can't speak for these Indian Maoists that she's talking about, but let me start out by answering it this way. To the degree that there is truth, any truth to what she's saying, to the degree that there would be any truth to that, there should not be. That the revolution that we are about should certainly be able to encompass the Arundhati Roys, in fact, not only encompass but welcome them and their role, as maddening as it might be at times. You know, because she's going to be proceeding from a different world outlook. But we have to understand that that's part of what we not only have to recognize is objectively going to be there for a whole period of transition, but also is going to, you know, or can, especially the more that we relate to it correctly, can contribute to where we're seeking to go. That's the whole point about not only allowing, but welcoming and fostering dissent. That's the whole point epistemologically about how all truths are good for the proletariat. Everything that's actually true can help us get to communism. So the role of people like that should be one that should be embraced within the kind of socialist state, the kind of dictatorship of the proletariat that we should be striving to establish and to carry forward. So it should not be true. You know, people like this raise, I mean, one of the things we should say to her, we should struggle over her world outlook and her political outlook and struggle with her that she ought to be a communist herself. But given that we may not win that struggle, at least not for a while, we have to correctly understand, you know, what's correct about what people like that raise when whatever particulars they raise and what's incorrect about it. But more than that, what role it plays in contributing to the kind of process, intellectual ferment, political ferment, the whole elasticity that we want in socialist society. And we have to, first of all, ideologically orient ourselves the right way toward this. This has to do with fundamental questions of epistemology, has to do with embraces but does not replace. You know, it has to do with the fact that at any given time, while in an overall and ultimate sense, consistently and systematically applying the communist world outlook and method in the best possible way enables you ultimately and in a fundamental and all-around sense to get more deeply to the truth than any other world outlook and methodology, qualitatively so. It doesn't mean that at any given time you necessarily have the truth about something. That's a contradiction we have to learn to handle much more correctly than has been handled in the past in our movement and in the history of the, you know, socialist countries. So, you know, people like Arundhati Roy or others may be raising criticisms coming from a different perspective, a different ideological perspective, and a different political perspective than the leading forces inside the socialist society. But they may still bring forward important truths, and even if they don't in any particular instance, it's important that there be the kind of atmosphere where they are encouraged to bring forward their ideas and to be part of and to create and to help stimulate the intellectual and the political ferment that we need, through which we, with our methodology, have to be continually sifting through, embracing, integrating, and more deeply synthesizing in the correct way. If you really get this, the point, I've said this before, if you really get this epistemology, you want people to challenge you. Do you want to know the truth, or do you just want to impose your will? Do you really want to act in the interests of the masses of people in abolishing the four alls and moving humanity to a whole new stage? Or do you just want to get in a position where you can do what you think is right? This is a fundamental difference ideologically and epistemologically between those two worldviews. And if you really get this communist epistemology, as I understand it, you do understand why everything that is actually true will help you get to communism. It doesn't mean everything that's actually true makes it easier in the short run. People point out your mistakes, and it may make difficulties, and their pointing them out may make difficulties. Not just because they're voicing them, but because it'll resonate with other people who have grievances and even other forces in society who will misuse legitimate grievances of others. But if you're afraid of that, then you can't get where we need to go. And this is something, the reason that people should believe us is, first of all, because we should believe it ourselves. As I've said before, this is not a gimmick. This is not a way of tricking people who are afraid we're going to impose our, will on them into thinking, oh, no, we're a nice bunch of liberals. Don't worry. No, we're not liberals. But we are not going to impose our will or seek to in that kind of way for much more fundamental reasons. So we should believe this ourselves, first of all. Doesn't mean we don't struggle for what we think is correct at a given time. If you don't do that, you're not worth anything to anyone, worth anything. But even while you're struggling vigorously for what you understand to be true, you have to maintain your critical faculties, your critical thinking, your openness to others contesting your ideas, no matter what viewpoint they're coming from, to see if there's truth in what they're raising in opposition to you. It gets very complicated. One of her big things, Arundhati Roy, is opposing a lot of these dams in India. Well, the way they do build these dams in these societies run by exploiting classes and under the overall domination of imperialism has horrendous effects on people. But, when you get around to socialism, you got to develop the economy. And you don't do this without a lot of contradictions, some of them becoming quite acute. Might it be necessary to dislocate some people in the course of developing the socialist economy and move them to another place? Yes. But you have to do that in a whole different way than it's done under these exploiting systems. And you have to do it in a way that ultimately rests on the voluntary action of masses of people based on their understanding and being one to the greater good. Like, there was a struggle like that. I talked in a memoir about going to see the, And when I was in China the first time and visiting the area where they built the Red Flag Canal. And they diverted a river through a mountain. And the effect of that on the villagers who lived alongside where the river had gone was negative. They didn't flood their village out, but it did mean that they weren't getting the same irrigation they'd gotten before. Didn't mean they didn't get any. But this was done for the larger good of being able to provide irrigation for agriculture to a much larger area and much greater numbers of people. And they had to win people to that voluntarily. They had to struggle through the ideological and political questions and struggle against the small owner mentality that the peasants were still caught up in to a large degree, because in the old society, that's where they were. They were exploited largely under the feudal system, but as small landowners. And if they didn't have land, they were trying to get it because that's the way they could live. And there's a certain ideology that goes along with that. Generally, a sort of a petty bourgeois ideology. They had to struggle through those questions ideologically. Well, you get an Arundhati Roy coming in and raising things that may divide sharply into two. Some of them may be legitimate criticism of the way you're going about it, and some of them may be wrong. because she's not seeing the larger picture. So you're going to have to struggle through and sift out those things. But even when, you know, in the aspect or to the degree that someone like that is wrong, what is your orientation toward that? That's the fundamental question of outlook and philosophy and epistemology. Is that going to contribute directly or indirectly, positively and negatively, to our getting to a deeper understanding of reality and a deeper understanding of how to transform reality in the interest of achieving the four alls and emancipating humanity, or is it not? If you understand that it is, then you have a certain orientation toward it, which is the one we should have. If you don't understand that it is, and you just think these goddamn people are always making trouble, every time we try to do something, they come around and stand in the way of what we're trying to do, literally or, figuratively. And there'll be some truth to that. You know, these contradictions have to be handled non-antagonistically. Unless, you know, someone comes around, you're trying to carry out an economic project, and they actually start blowing up the machinery, then they've carried it over to another realm. Then they're not merely arguing with you about it or waging a protest. Then they're going into another realm, and then you have to act accordingly. But even while doing that, there's still a difference between having to act accordingly in those circumstances and what your attitude should be in an overall sense toward this phenomenon in general of people raising disagreements, criticizing what you're doing, pointing out shortcomings. Look, you know, Mao said we have to toughen our skin. You do have to toughen your skin if you're going to do this the right way. People disagree with you, they criticize you, they're not always so polite, sometimes they're downright fucking nasty. But you still have to have an orientation of sifting through to see what's true, and you have to have an orientation of creating an atmosphere in society which is favorable to this happening, or we're not going to get where we need to go. But we still, on the other side of it, we do need, and the reason that Arundhati Roy should believe us is that A, we should believe it, and B, our practice, our methodology, the way we carry out things should flow from and be consistent with that, and it should be borne out. Everybody, when they hear somebody say something that's controversial or something that they're not inclined to believe or not sure is true, tests people out in various ways. That's part of the process too. You engage in discussion and struggle, but you also observe and interact with people. This is what happens not just with this or that prominent individual, but with people generally, and the masses of people. Masses of people have the same questions. Why should we believe you? That sounds good, but how do we know this isn't going to go over here, where we've been told this always goes? Or I heard that your people over there in China did X, Y, and Z. First time I talked with Mobile, he told me, well, one of the brothers from the neighborhood told me, I heard your people over there in China did all this kind of stuff to people. You know, so, the, you know, people, masses out there hearing this stuff. It's not just a few people, you know, who read about it more extensively. So, you know, there's a question of do you really deeply, not just believe in some quasi-religious sense, you grasp deeply the truth that by toughening our skin and in not only allowing in sort of a, you know, grit your teeth way, but in actually encouraging and fostering the atmosphere where there will be intellectual and political ferment that we can sift through and get further along and actually get where we need to go ultimately, and that if we don't do that, we won't get there. This is the fundamental question. Now, we do have to have a solid core. This goes to the other part of what you raise. If people want to get up and give speeches about how we ought to go back to capitalism and attack the leadership and so on, you know, of the new society, and we don't allow that, then we're going against the atmosphere we need to create. And, you know, it's very tricky because, for example, in Cuba, you know, like, which is not a socialist country, it's a revisionist country, and so, you know, sort of social democratic-y social welfare for some of the people, you know, enforced with ultimately a bourgeois dictatorship. But one of the ways they exercise coercion, which is effectively state coercion, is that if, you know, when they get dissidents and so on, they mobilize these neighborhood committees and masses of people to surround these people raising dissidents, raising criticism, and basically try to, you know, effectively, you know, or figuratively, if not literally, shout them down. Well, I'm not saying that there's never a role for mobilizing the people who are firmest supporters of the revolution under socialism. You're just going to let the reactionaries run wild or people who are dissenting get out there and voice, and you're never going to mobilize, you know, people on your side of the of a dispute. But even that has to be approached very carefully and from the correct orientation, because even that can provide an atmosphere that becomes tantamount to and effectively the same as invoking, imposing the state to suppress dissent. If you create an atmosphere which chills dissent, even in that form, you are effectively doing the same thing as if you brought the state down against it. But that is different than people who actually, I'm sorry, you know, we're living in class-divided society in socialism. And we might wish that weren't true, but there are a lot of things we wish weren't true. You know, I mean, that's what progressive labor, they used to have, you know, they used to have, back in their not-so-terrible days, just bad days, they used to have, you know, a slogan, fight for socialism. I knew some people from PL who were called to the HUAC hearings, or the equivalent hearings, you know, congressional committees to investigate subversives. And, you know, I have to give them credit. They went back and raised a ruckus and challenged, you know, all these Southern cracker congressmen and senators who were heading all these committees investigating communism and pointed out what was going on in the states of these congressmen and senators in terms of the oppression of black people and other things. And I remember one of them telling me a story about because you're being called by the committee, you get flown back at the expense of the government and put up in a hotel. So they were in a hotel and they, you know, going up the elevator at night, one night during the course of the hearings, and they had on their fight for socialism buttons. And this drunken congressman got on the elevator with them with each arm around a prostitute and looked at their button and said, "Oh, fight for socialism. I used to be for socialism. Is that like Norman Thomas and the Socialist Party?" And they said, "No, this is like Mao Zedong." I see this was in their not-so-terrible days. So they used to have that slogan, fight for socialism. Then they decide, oh, that socialism's a big mess. So now let's just go directly to communism. Let's not bother about socialism. Well, they might as well just say, why don't we all just go to heaven? You know, why bother with Earth? It's full of a lot of mess. You know, this is just rampant idealism. So we're going to have these class conflicts and reactionary forces who are going to meet and not just grumble, but plot. And they're actually going to implement things. They're going to go out. Look, it's like I said, the bourgeoisie and counter-revolutionaries are not going to sit back and say, let's see what happens. They say this is a better society in every sphere, not just economically, but politically, culturally, socially, philosophically, morally. Well, let's see if they can make that be true. They're going to actively plot because they don't want it to be true. And they don't want it to be fulfilled. And when they actively plot and go from plotting on top of it to actually carrying out, in other words, this happened in the Soviet Union. People blew up plants. You know, blew up factories. Because that sabotage would undermine the economy and would drive the masses away from supporting and being enthusiastic about the new system. And the new, you know, not only new economic system, but the new political system. Well, if you allow that to go on, then you are in effect just, might as well just hand power back to these people and save yourself the trouble and save the masses the trouble and just say, go ahead and do your worst to the masses of people. So there is a distinction there. You know, these boundaries have to be, you know, once again, they're conditional and relative, but they're real. There is a difference between raising a lot of criticism and arguing that this system's no good and so on, and actually actively plotting and then carrying out plots to sabotage it. And in law and in constitution and in the way it's carried out, that distinction has to be made, and the masses and the vanguard have to understand the importance of that distinction. Those are two different types of contradictions. One of them should be handled non-antagonistically, and the other is antagonistic and has to be dealt with by the force of the state, or you might as well just give it up. So if we can actually grasp this deeply and lead growing sections of the masses to grasp this deeply, then there should definitely be a place and a welcoming atmosphere for all the Arundhati Roys, even with all their cantankerousness, which will get raised a lot against us instead of against the people it's rightly raised against now. But even all that cantankerousness should be strategically and fundamentally welcomed and embraced as part of what we're seeking to do, because it's the world we want to get to and because it's the way to get to that world. So there should be not only room in some negative sense, but there should be an atmosphere where these people feel welcome even while they have and often express very sharp differences over particularities, and we should be working to win them over at the same time, to raise their sights, to help, to say to them, instead of simply standing outside being a critic, get inside and raise your criticism, but also contribute more fully to making this be what it should be and can be. And while they're still on the outside, then we have to approach them in the ways I'm talking about, and not in the ways that she fears she would be approached.